Birdie Peach, sheriff for the town of Beaver, showed the telegram to Slade Yellowbone.
Seems our services are required down in Red Pony.
Peach had always considered himself superior to most men he knew or could name, which was just about everybody. His deputy, Slade Yellowbone, was a tall, gaunt, and hollow-eyed fella who wasn't given much to words, and was as dangerous a man as Birdie Peach had ever known. In Birdie's mind, having Slade as his deputy was sort of like keeping a fighting dog on a chain. One thing that Birdie never told anyone was that he was always fully prepared to put Slade down if it ever came to that. Shoot him from behind, in the back of the head. But until that day came, Slade was a good one to take along to a fight.
What they need us for?
Slade looked out the window of the Beaver office, a cigarette dangling from the corner of his mouth. The view he had was of a dull gray sky that threatened more snow. He hated snow because the cold made his groin ache. Ever since that woman had shot him in Glorietta. These days, if he rode a horse or train or stage anywhere, he sat on a red pillow that had the words, "Home Sweet Home," stitched in yellow. The only thing that would relieve his ache was cocaine pills, which he bought from a Chinaman. It had gotten so bad that he couldn't go more than a few hours without one. Of course, washing him down with whiskey aided the effect.
You remember John Henry Cole, don't you?
Sure, features himself as some sort of gunfighter extraordinaire.
Well, he is precisely that. He'll put a plug in you quick if you fool with him.
So I'm guessing he's the one who sent that?
No, not him. It was sent by Lou Ford, the town marshal down there. Says John Henry Cole and his bunch of detectives got their asses shot up by the Sam Star gang. Drilled three of Cole's boys and wounded him and another man. Says that the town council's afraid Star will come and burn down the town. They find out Cole's still alive and living there.
Sounds like a bunch of yard chickens.
Slade had his mind on something. It was something he'd had his mind on for a long time. Why that young store clerk with those real blue eyes and those soft features kept haunting him, preying on his mind.
I ain't a queer duck.
That burger Red Pony will never amount to nothing if the Northern don't put in a spur line. It will die and blow away.
You thinking on going?
I am the sheriff, and it's my duty when I'm called.
Slade looked at his boss skeptically.
Must be some reward money in it.
Birdie smiled.
A good deal, in fact, now that you mention it.
He spread out the wanted posters on the Sam Star gang and did a rough calculation of the amount to be collected if he got all of them.
I figure there's close to $2,000 worth of killers just out there waiting to be had.
Birdie wasn't real good with numbers. Toting, adding, subtracting, multiplying. But he could count to $2,000 given enough time. Slade didn't say anything. He was thinking about what that clerk had said to him yesterday when he'd gone into the mercantile to buy a new shirt.
Say, that'll look real nice on you, Mr. Yellowbone.
There was just something about the way he said it as he held the shirt up to him.
Why don't you just go ahead and try it on?
So Slade had taken off the old shirt and put on the new one. He had seen the way the clerk was watching him when he took off his old shirt, and then seen how nice he looked in that new shirt once he'd put it on.
You're a handsome man, Mr. Yellowbone.
No, there ain't nothing to that.
But then the clerk had given him a discount.
Now, I'm not supposed to do this, but I want to give you a discount because the shirt looks so good on you, like you was meant to have it.
Jody was his name, Jody Weatherspoon. Slade wondered how he'd come to care enough to memorize that kid's name.
Oh, don't worry. It will just be our little secret. Yours and mine, Mr. Yellowbone.
The boy had this real thick curly hair he wore long, and he was as slender as a schoolgirl to boot. Had hairless cheeks and a real soft, tiny mouth. What first caught Slade's attention was that the boy had a limp, like his right leg wouldn't bend at the knee. He wanted to ask him about it, how it came to be that way, just to keep the conversation going, to justify lingering there in the store and talking to the kid some more.
Damn it. Stop thinking such thoughts.
Well?
Slade turned from the window, from staring across the street at Mangrove's Mercantile, where the kid worked.
Well, what?
Well, you ready to go earn some money?
I reckon.
Pack your bag. We'll head out on the afternoon stage.
Looks like it's bound to snow.
Well, if it does, it does.
I might want to wait a day or two, see how the weather's gonna break.
The sheriff merely shook his head.
Time's money. Go pack.
Slade nodded and turned his eyes back to the window, to the Mercantile. Then he left to pack, get his extra guns and that new blue shirt, go get himself a drink or two, and see was Fanny in and available over at Ellis's Hog Palace. The afternoon stage wouldn't leave for another 2 hours. He had time. Time to prove there wasn't nothing wrong with him, that he was as normal as any man. So he went and he found Fanny, and that time of day she was available. Slade dug out the $3 she charged and another for the bottle to take to her room with them. He went at it with Fanny as if the train was due in 2 minutes instead of 2 hours. He did it without pleasure, then rolled out of her bed and got dressed.
That was real fine, Slade. Best I ever had.
He knew that she was lying, but that was her job, to lie and make men want to crow like a rooster so that they would return time and again. It's how a gal like her made a living. Not as much by screwing as by lying.
Tell the truth!
I swear to God and Jesus, Slade. I never had it from no man like you just gave it to me. Never!
He let it go. He wanted to convince himself that for the first time, a woman like her hadn't lied to a man like him.
All right, then. Anybody ever ask you how old Slade is in the sack, you make sure and tell him I'm the best you ever had. You hear me?
Sure, Slade. Sure.
He walked out and went to his hotel room and gathered his things and put them in a leather valise, making sure to keep his new shirt on top so it wouldn't get all wrinkled. Then he armed himself with several guns and went off to the stage stop to wait along with Bertie Peach.
Where's your pillow, Slade?
Shit, I forgot it.
He went all the way back to the hotel and got his red pillow and started again for the stage stop when he nearly bumped into the clerk, young Weatherspoon, coming out of the mercantile.
Howdy, Mr. Yellowbone. How are you?
Slade looked at him with hooded eyes. There was something mighty tempting about that boy.
I'm leaving town for a few days.
Slade hurried on, pillow in hand.
Pretty pillow.
Lou Ford was summoned to a meeting of the town council, made up of the local businessmen, Mayor Cal Feathers, and the Reverend Mr. Payworthy of the Good Pilgrims Quaker United Holiness Church. They laid before Lou their fears.
You go and tell John Henry Cole and Charlie Hood that they must leave town as soon as possible. Elsewise, the Star Bunch might come and burn us out.
Don't be foolish.
You're the town marshal. It's your job to do all you can to protect the citizens of Red Pony.
Lou saw their pitiful, worried faces and knew which side his bread was buttered on. If he refused them, they would fire him and hire someone else who would abide by their wishes. Lou lacked the confidence in himself to find other work. He had a wife to support, after all.
But John Henry is a friend of mine.
Friend or not, he must go, for the good of others.
At the boarding house, Cole knew why Lou had come. Lou held his bowler hat in his hand, turning it like a plate.
John Henry, the town council wants you and Charlie to leave Red Pony post-haste. I hate to be the messenger, but...
I'm willing to go if that's what y'all want. But Charlie's stove up, shot through the legs, and I'm not so sure he's able or willing.
He watched Lou's face closely. It seemed made of putty that had sat in the hot sun too long. Cole suspected that at one time or another, Lou had been a man of resolve and great inner strength, but that time and marriage and other responsibilities had weakened him over the years, leaving him overly cautious, tentative, even fearful, as it does so many men. He thought about what he wanted to say to Lou Ford.
When we're young, we feel invulnerable. We feel as though we can win every argument, that nothing can deter us from our goals. But when we grow old, we lose all sense of ourselves and our goals, and we lean too heavily on other men to bear us up.
That's what he wanted to tell Lou Ford, in order to brace him.
We was hoping you would be the one to go and tell Charlie, since he's an employee of yours.
Best you tell him yourself. I'll not carry your water for you.
Then I will. We'd like you to leave by tomorrow.
So say y'all?
Mm-hmm.
You'll be the only law here.
We've sent for Bertie Peach. He should be arriving any day with deputies.
So be it then.
Cole did not offer to shake hands. Lou stood for a moment, then donned his bowler hat and left. Cole put together his bedroll. He didn't own much. He saw the accumulation of things as something unnecessary to a man of his way of life. He had always been of the mind to be ready to travel and to travel light. His days as a lawman had taught him to be ready for almost anything. You might have a job when you wake up in the morning and be put out of work by afternoon. Or it might be just the opposite. This was one reason why he'd bought the land in New Mexico, to have a place to light finally when his law-dogging days were over. Town councils hired men to do their dirty work, to keep their town safe. And once they got what they wanted, they got rid of the men who made them that way and hired other, gentler men who wore silk cravats and threaded waistcoats. Men who carried a pocket pistol and brass watch and had clean-shaven cheeks and thoughts of someday moving on to obtain higher office. Politicians, not real lawmen. You lived each day as if it was your last, and sometimes it was your last. Lawmen were shot by drunk cowboys and crazy women and hardened killers. Shot and delivered up to the boneyard. And that was sometimes how you moved on, too. But either way, you moved on. Nothing was permanent for a man who worked behind a gun. He finished his packing and sat on the edge of the bed. He fashioned himself a cigarette, then struck a match and smoked, inhaling deeply until his thoughts lifted, carried on the airiness of the smoke itself. If the town didn't want him, he didn't want the town.
Maybe it's time. Maybe this is a sign that it's time to hang up your guns and go live on that little place of yours and let the world alone.
But he knew that before he could let it alone, he had to take care of one last matter. When he answered the knock and opened the door, Franzetta stood with eyes wet and red.
Come in.
She did, and stood there for the longest time.
John Henry?
Franzetta.
For another moment, they breathed the air in the Spartan room, and she looked about, but there wasn't a lot to see. A bed, a bureau, china pitcher and bowl, both chipped. A small dark painting on the wall of a boat with men in it rowing against raging waves. Every time Cole had looked at it, he was sure those men in the boat were goners. And of course there were his books there on shelves. The one saving grace of a bachelor was his books, wherein he could escape to faraway worlds and peer in at the lives of others.
The town council wants us out of town.
I know. Lou Ford came here first, told me to hit the road, and wanted me to tell you and Charlie. I told him to do it himself. Figured they wouldn't run poor Charlie and you off, him shot in the legs.
Well, they're doing it.
The secret that only Cole and Franzetta shared was their brief past together, before Charlie came to Red Pony and hired on. Franzetta had been a refugee from the East, a part of a traveling troupe of actors touring the West. She'd broken her ankle, fallen off the stage, and was left behind, where she eventually took work as a waitress at the Morning Cafe. This is where Cole had met her. There was an instant attraction between them, a fire that burned brightly, but as such fires often do, it had also burned out quickly. Franzetta was a woman with a somewhat regal bearing, had that green-eyed, imperious gaze, aquiline nose, and high cheekbones. She was of an age by the time she and Cole met when most women were married with children. But Franzetta had never been married, although she confessed to a string of lovers during their brief affair. Cole had never met such an openly sexual woman. It was just one of those deals that happened, and they both realized it and accepted it for what it was. An encounter of two strangers who found themselves lonely and in need of something they just couldn't find anywhere. Cole had liked that she was also well-read and loved the fact that he had books. When it ended, the heat all dissipated. Neither of them could say exactly why it had. Cole looked at those books now, his accumulation on the shelves in his room, and knew he'd have to have them shipped to his place on the Canadian River, that they would stave off the lonely days ahead. And each time he looked at them, he couldn't help but remember those torrid nights and seamless, languid days he'd spent with Franzetta. Even now, as she stood there looking about, he felt a tinge of passion for her. He wondered if she, too, remembered that first night they'd spent together when they had gone back to her small, rented cottage and gotten out of their clothes in the semi-darkness with just enough light to see each other. And how those shadows and light had played over the graceful curves of her hips and breasts. How she had looked as if she were made of ivory. He asked himself how it was possible not to think such things, then as quickly admonished himself because she was now Charlie's wife. In fact, it was Cole who had introduced her to Charlie, and he had been mildly surprised that Charlie and Franzetta had hit it off, for they seemed like two such opposites. Charlie was the same height as Franzetta and older by several years. He didn't read books. Cole wasn't even sure that Charlie could read. Charlie liked to have a good time, drinking, with lots of laughter. He was always playing practical jokes, whereas Franzetta seemed reserved and humorless. But something connected them, something invisible and unknowable. And so it had been.
I'm not sure what to do, John Henry. Charlie's wounded and can barely hobble around even with crutches, and now they're kicking us out of town. God damn them for that.
I keep a place west of here over in New Mexico. It's not much, nothing fancy, but we'd be okay there, the three of us. At least until Charlie can get up and around again. You're both welcome to come.
Do you think that's a good idea, John Henry?
I think we don't have much of a choice, but it's up to you and Charlie.
I'll speak to him. That won't happen again, will it?
She turned and touched her hand to the doorknob.
I mean, what happened before, that won't happen again.
No, it won't happen again.
He couldn't read her expression or what she was thinking when she said that. She turned and went out. Cole made himself another shuck and smoked it as he awaited word from Charlie whether they would all leave together. Then there was that question she'd asked him about if it would happen again between them. And he told himself that it would not, could not. But it made him fidgety, thinking it might be hard to be around her. He checked his watch, put it away, and then checked it again. The stiffness in his side and shoulder tugged at him like teeth biting into him. But he outlasted the worst of it by pacing the room with murder still on his mind. He had never before wanted simply to hunt somebody down and kill them, but now he did. What Sam had done was unpardonable. Becoming an outlaw was one thing. Becoming an assassin who would ambush men trying to do the right thing was another. He hated himself for feeling so much anger and told himself he'd be little better than Sam were he to do that thing, hunt him down and kill him without giving him a chance. But what else was there for it? He paced, then cleaned his guns, then paced some more.
Come on, Charlie, make up your damn mind. Either you're going or you're not.
Cole wasn't sure, but that getting shot had ruined Charlie, as it did some men. Cole had seen some of the bravest men he ever knew beg and plead for their mothers or wives when they took a bullet and sensed how close to dying they were. He could understand it, but not in himself. Preacher Man came knocking instead of Charlie Hood. He stood there in his black clothing beneath a heavy overcoat of wool.
Wanted to see how you were making out. See, was there anything more I could do for you? Or if you'd like me to pray with you.
Cole allowed him entrance.
I've no need of praying, Preacher. No offense.
Oh, none taken. The other reason I've come is that I've been hearing rumors about the men who shot you and your friends, that they may try and finish you by coming here. Some are even saying that if they come, they might burn down the entire town. Folks seem nervous about your existence.
Nothing new there. I'd offer you a whiskey if I was still a drinking man, but I gave it up.
Preacher Man's face drew into a smile.
Well, I always keep a bit of Old Toss on hand.
He produced a bottle of peppermint schnapps from within his broad coat.
Hope you don't mind.
Go ahead, and I'll watch with envy.
Cole watched the bubbles form in the bottle as Preacher Man drank. Two good swallows, then he plugged the neck.
Whew, Lordy. Sweet as flower and nectar. So, may I ask what your plans are in light of the situation?
Why do you want to know?
I'm a man at loose ends. Been searching for myself, my place in this world for ever so long. I got a wagon and two ornery mules and thought maybe you would like to employ my services.
Fortuitous, Cole thought, about the wagon. He glanced at his books. Maybe he could pack them in a trunk after all, rather than leave them. And if Charlie and Franzetta came along, they'd need the benefit of a wagon as well. The thought of leaving it all galled him, but...
How much would it take to hire you and your wagon?
Not much. $1 a day and my meals, and perhaps a couple more bottles of schnapps for those cold nights. How would that suit you?
Suits me fine.
When do you want to leave?
As soon as I get word back from my friend.
Preacher Man stood there, and Cole could see he was waiting for something. So he took $2 silver from a tin box he kept on a shelf by his books and handed them over.
$2, 2 days.
Preacher Man nodded.
I'll be at that tavern on yon corner when you're ready to go.
Good enough.
The sun crossed from one side of the sky to the other, then slowly began to lower itself toward Earth. It was a ball of red, muted by the thin gray sky, shining bloodily upon the old snow. Finally, Cole went to Charlie's place to get an answer. Charlie opened the door, leaning on a pair of crutches.
Franzetta has agreed that we go with you to your place on the Canadian. She's packing a trunk now, some of her dishware, particular things she feels she can't do without.
I'm glad you're coming. We'll use Preacher Man's wagon to move.
It ain't like we're running. Is it, John Henry?
Call it what you want. It is whatever it is. But no matter what, I'm not through with that bunch. And as soon as I've got you and her settled, I intend to take care of business.
Arrest them?
No, Charlie. Finish them.
Charlie half smiled, for he knew that John Henry Cole was not a man to declare such things without fully meaning them. He looked back over his shoulder, then toward Cole again.
I hope the hell I'm up to it, too.
You've done enough, Charlie. You paid your wages on this one. Franzetta needs you more than I do. I'll see it done. Don't you worry about that. Just get ready, and I'll come around before it gets dark, and we'll head out of this burg.
Charlie nodded. Cole handed the Thunderer to him.
Figured you'd want this back.
Charlie nodded again, but that was all. Cole turned and went to pack his favorite books and a few other things into a small travel trunk. Surely, as the sun sank down into the far line of snowy horizon, turning the clouds that streaked the sky to a lovely crimson, Cole and Charlie and Franzetta rode away from Red Pony in Preacher Man's spring wagon, the iron wheels crunching in the brittle snow following the mules.
We'll make the next town, Pistol, and lay over there for the night. It's about 10 miles up this road.
The rest of the journey into night was pretty much done in cold silence, each of the travelers wrapped up in blankets and their own thoughts. The mules seemed oblivious to everything.
Beast of burden. Blessed are the ignorant. Now the day is over. Night is drawing nigh. Shadows of the evening still across the sky.
Jesus. Preacher Man's voice soothed Franzetta's shivering soul and gave her a minuscule bit of hope. She leaned her body against Charlie's, and he put his arm around her shoulders and drew her near as he gazed up at the star-salted sky, the sliver of moon.
It'll be okay, love. It'll be okay.
Preacher Man nipped at the schnapps, offering it to Charlie and Franzetta, who each nipped a little for the warmth it put into the blood. Between hymns, Preacher Man looked over at Cole.
My mules like my singing to them. Keeps them from becoming obnoxious.
They rode on and eventually reached the town of Pistol, where they took rooms at a stark hotel, knocked together of plain, unpainted lumber. But they were ever so glad to be in out of the black cold and resting in beds. Cole would not allow himself to think of Franzetta and Charlie in the next room, or of anything other than soon wreaking revenge on his half-brother, whom he considered no kin at all. He knew he shouldn't rightfully feel that way, but he did. The old walls of the hotel creaked from the cold. Every passing minute was to him like a bitter pill to swallow. The cold made the pain of his wounds maddening and seemed to come in waves, and each time it did, he was tempted to go and find a bottle of whiskey, but he fought the urge, believing that the pain was nothing more than a necessary reminder of what he must do. He closed his eyes, and finally the world went away. Sam Starr was a man with a face that spoke of ruthlessness and carnage. It was youthful and feral at the same time. It was his eyes that told the true story. They were as pitiless and black as a starless night. He was honey-haired, which added to the initial deception. The creases around his eyes were grimed with the soot of 1,000 campfires. Reddish-blonde whorls of whisker hair graced his cheeks and chin and upper lip. To see him from a distance would make you think of a boy struggling into manhood, a dirty, restless boy. Add to this the long braid of honey-colored hair he kept tied with red ribbons, and a stranger gazing upon him might think feminine. But a closer inspection would reveal scars, nicks, and cuts from knives and fists and broken bottles. Much of his right ear had been shot away by an irate husband, a man Sam Starr had murdered simply because he could. One of the many men he'd killed. Starr was a man who knew the taste of blood, his own and that of others. He'd once read about strange beasts somewhere in Europe in some dark forest who lived off the blood of their victims. It was said that such blood made these man-beasts stronger and kept them alive, and that folks were afraid to leave their houses at night for fear of these beasts getting hold of them and draining their blood. Starr felt like such a man-beast. Sometimes in the bloodiest of fights, the other fella's blood would get on him, splatter up into his face and mouth and eyes, and then he would taste it. And it tasted metallic and thickly salted like every other sort of blood, even the kind in an animal killed and eaten for supper. Well, such was blood, and such were the ways of an outlaw, and Sam Starr didn't care anything about any of it one way or the other. He was what he was, Sometimes, in the darkest part of the night, he wept for his mother, the loss of her, his departure from her loving ways, her care. And so, too, he missed his pa, even being the son of a bitch that he'd been. And now and again, he thought of his half-brother, John Henry Cole, how he used to envy him, but then came to hate him for cuffing him around whenever he'd do something of which Cole did not approve. One time he had hit Cole with a rock in his eye, and he had seen how that hurt Cole, and it had given him a sense of power that comes with an act of brutality, and he had liked the way it felt. He sometimes wondered, too, how he and Cole had ended up on opposite sides of the law, except that God ordained it. Sam Starr, for all his sins, believed that everything was God's plan, and that nobody could do anything to change what God meant for them to be or do. That's just the way it was. It was while Cole was away fighting in the war that their ma passed, and Starr went to live with an aunt over in the neighboring county, a widow whose husband had been killed in the war. It had been arranged that in exchange for her care and room and board, Starr would work her crops and do all the manly things that the husband would have done were he there. Starr, just 14 at the time, didn't know anything about anything except that he was alone in the world, and so was she. One night, after a long, hot summer day of working, hoeing weeds from the crop of corn and other chores, the two of them were alone in that big old house, falling down around their ears.
Little Sam, darling, you are the sweetest soul, and I will love you forever, in this world and the next.
She'd taken to calling him by the name of her late husband. She'd been drinking dandelion wine most of that day and into the evening, and offered him some.
Here. Drink this.
He liked the taste of the wine right off, like the way it made him feel once it got down into his blood. Seemed like everything eventually came down to the blood. She was a red-haired beauty, to be sure, and men were always coming around, traipsing up to the cabin, knocking on the door. She'd let them in, telling Starr to go off and find something to work at for an hour or so. When he'd return, there would sometimes be money on the table that hadn't been there before.
Aunt Jean, why do those men leave money when you...
Don't you take to judging me. Don't you damn dare. Drink up. Well, I tell you what, little Sam, it gets real lonely around here. For a woman like me, alone at so young
that
age...
That particular night, they drank an entire jug of dandelion wine, then started on a second. She was dressed in a loose sack dress, nothing beneath it. He remembered, too, that she was barefooted. She talked on in an alcohol-fueled ramble about one thing and another, about loneliness mostly, what it was like for a woman alone at so young an age, and that the worst was the nights spent alone, even if she'd been with men earlier in the day.
Oh, sure. There's some men who come around to court me, or who would take me. They don't want no kid that ain't theirs to raise. And I say to hell with them for that. Then there's the old, the halt, the lame who'd marry me. But what do I want with the likes of them, little Sam?
He had no answer. His head was spinning. The flames in the fireplace seemed like little yellow people dancing and hopping about. Or demons.
I think I'm getting drunk, Aunt Jane. And so are you.
I won't deny it. And I'm thinking you won't deny that it's time you stop being a boy. And start growing into your manhood. Would you like that? I would.
He'd think of her over the years and of that long, dark night. The feel of her naked body against his. The shadows created by the firelight dancing on the walls, flickering over them like wicked tongues. He hadn't known what he should do, but went by instinct and her guidance. It all seemed so strange, and that feeling twisted inside him like a strand of white-hot wire for a while. But the very next morning when she awoke, his life took another turn for the worse.
You! What are you still doing here? You go. And don't come back. You are stained with the worst sin.
You took advantage of me! Your own flesh and blood! Oh, you are a sinful little bastard! Get your things! And get gone! And don't ever come back here!
Her words shattered and confused him. Hurt, he went away. But he found himself without any way to sustain his life, except by hook or by crook. He had robbed an old man, beat him over the head with a chunk of firewood, left him bleeding and near lifeless. Took his watch, what little money he had, a slab of bacon and two cans of beans and one of peaches. He then stole the man's old horse and rode away. 16 years of such activity had left him a hardened, wanted man who sometimes secretly wept at night for that crazy bitch of an aunt. The short man came into the camp's light.
Well, I'll spread the word around that we might be coming to Red Pony and burn that town to the ground if we found that son of a bitch John Henry Cole and any of his boys still alive and living there.
You did well, Shorty.
Damned if I didn't.
Shorty sat by the fire and was passed a bottle from a case of stolen whiskey. Four others sat around that same fire. Killers, every last one.
You actually gonna do it?
Shit, what do you think?
Shorty shrugged.
What I learned when I was back there was that some of them was killed. Three's the number I was told. Two lived. Cole and one other. Feller named Hood.
Charlie Hood. I know that sumbitch too. Used to be a law dog in Las Vegas. Killed a friend of mine, Leo Bass. Damn it.
I say damn that town and all them who's still alive in it. No matter the number. Why waste our time and take foolish chances by going at them again? Especially when what we could use more of is money and fun times.
Star looked across the fire at Black Bill. He wasn't a Negro, he was just a dark-skinned something or other. Likely there was some Mexican or Cajun mixed in with his white blood. But everybody called him Black Bill, and he didn't seem to care. He favored wearing sateen shirts and shaggy chaps and wore the brim of his hat pinned back to the crown with a big brass pin. He had fancy-stitched boots with roses on the shafts and curlicues on the toes. He claimed he had the biggest pecker west of the Mississippi, and maybe east of it, too, depending on what day he was claiming it and how mad drunk he was. He bragged that he'd had 1,000 women, maybe more. He wore a gold pinky ring on his right hand with a stone that he claimed contained a drop of Jesus' blood, and wore a silver ring on his middle left finger. He sported a brace of ivory-handled pistols, Remington break-top models of a .44-40 caliber, big horse pistols, worn butts forward, he said, so he wouldn't shoot that big pecker off accidentally and cause a whole nation of women to go into mourning. He had an air about him that no man or woman could ever defeat him at anything. He said he'd wrestled steers and once killed a bear with his clasp knife in a fight. So when he said what he said about avoiding a raid on Red Pony, Sam Starr glared at him across the fire with those pitiless black eyes.
Tell me, if you could, the exact hour when you took over this gang.
It was a challenge Black Bill felt up to.
I thought we was robbers of banks and trains and everything else that had a dollar in it. When did assassination start paying?
Sam Starr looked around at the other faces. They were like feral dogs, eager for the taste of flesh and blood, like those creatures in Europe.
We'll take a vote.
Starr knew that leadership was a tenuous thing at best, that such men as these sitting around the fire could and would jump whichever way the wind blew. Outlaws were more independent than just about anyone else. They didn't care about rules, and often didn't follow anybody if they could help it. Whatever made the best sense to them at the moment was likely to get their vote.
All those in favor of going and finishing off those sons of bitches and maybe burning that town, raise your hands.
Only two did. Sam Starr and Shorty.
All right, then. The hell with it. We'll go rob that bank in Buffalo Jump. We'll get some money and have some fun. But after that, after we drunk all that whiskey and pleasured all the women, then we're going to Red Pony and find those bastards we failed to kill. And kill them. And if they're hiding, and the folks don't give them up, we'll burn that town so everybody knows not to fool with us anymore. We put the fear of God in them. Any damn objections to that?
The others figured he'd probably forget about it in time. They ate a stew of beans, jackrabbit, and creek water from a big black kettle and passed the stolen whiskey around. And Sam Starr kept thinking about what a pack of man-beasts they were. Strange warm winds blew in from the west, causing the winter to seem like an aberration. That time was out of whack, that there was some strange cosmic doings afoot. Nonetheless, no one aboard the spring wagon of Preacher Man complained about the change. They were grateful for it. And after 2 days' travel, they reached their destination, a sweep of land leading up to the cliffs of a canyon on the Canadian River. It wasn't much of a cabin yet, but had a privy out back and a small corral. Stacked nearby was a load of lumber and a pile of shake shingles he'd ordered delivered on his last trip there. Cole planned on adding 2 more rooms. The passengers climbed down wearily, heartened by the warm winds, and Preacher Man and Cole helped Charlie along, then returned for the trunks.
What the heck is in this one?
Books.
Books? I think that perhaps guns would be more in order, considering the situation.
Cole nodded toward another of the trunks.
Guns are in that one.
Finally, everything and everyone was settled inside, and Cole started a fire in the wood stove and another one in the cook stove.
We'll fix something to eat first.
I'll cook us all something.
Preacher and me will go get some water.
Franzetta began sorting through a box of dry goods that also contained cans of potted meat, while Cole and Preacher Man hauled up buckets of water from the nearest feeder stream of the river. Preacher Man openly admired the place.
I bet she's pretty in the summer. A veritable Eden.
Lots of good grass, plenty of game, good water, fish, you name it.
Everything a man needs. But one.
Oh? What would that be?
A woman to abide with thee.
Cole smiled.
You think?
Man is but half of himself without a woman to bear him along in troubled times and good.
You seem to know an awful lot about it for a preaching man.
Do you know what Jesus admonished?
I reckon he admonished quite a few things.
Preacher Man smiled knowingly.
The greatest of virtues is love. And who better for a man to love than a woman?
You sound like you've been there.
A time or two, yes.
Well, I reckon if or when the time comes, there could be room for a woman here. I'm not opposed to that. This is just lonesome country, is all. It would take a special sort of woman to live out here so far from anything.
And children?
And children.
They had a nice but rather simple meal, made do for extra chairs by bringing in a plank of lumber and resting it across 2 nailed kegs. Franzetta had prepared some corn dodgers, a pot of beans to go along with the potted meat, and coffee. She sat next to Charlie and across from Cole and Preacher Man, whose forehead was 2 shades of color without his black felt hat. He was nearly bald as well. Preacher Man had given a grace, and then they ate like wolves. Afterward, Cole and Preacher Man carried the dishes down to the feeder creek and washed them, while Franzetta and Charlie retired to the single bedroom, the one addition Cole had managed to add, figuring it was indecent to sleep in the same room a man ate in or had guests in, though he never had any guests before this day except for old Pablo, a neighbor a mile up the road who'd helped him some with the building when he could. Old Pablo was a man who came and went like a ghost and rode a skinny milk-white horse with pink-rimmed eyes. Sometimes in an evening when old Pablo had come around and helped hammer nails and saw planks and measure this and measure that, they'd sit outside and smoke cigarettes, and old Pablo would offer to share his tequila, what he called Mexican Mustang liniment, with Cole. But Cole, having given up drinking, would politely decline and drink black coffee instead. Old Pablo was a man who didn't say much unless he was drinking, and then he would regale Cole with stories about his youth from down along the border, meaning the border that ran along the Rio Grande in Texas.
I was a pretty bad hombre in my day. I done things I ain't proud of.
The more old Pablo would drink, the more stories he would tell without really giving anything away that might indict him for some crime or other. Knowing that Cole was once a lawman and currently a detective that mainly hunted outlaws for the reward money, it was almost as if old Pablo was toying with him, seeing how much he could confess to without confessing to anything.
Anybody comes around trying to steal something or squat, I'll put some birdshot in their ass.
Old Pablo was heavy in shoulder and belly. He had short, bowed legs, but when he was astride his skinny horse, he could appear fearsome. Old Pablo claimed he had some Comanche blood in him.
My grandmother was Texas Comanche. It was from her I learned to ride a horse before I could even walk. Comanches are the best horse people in the world.
Cole would drink his coffee and listen to old Pablo tell his stories and watch the evening descend in rosy shades, the sky streaked as if a painter had made it a final testament. Old Pablo might opine 1 minute and then the very next contradict himself.
Oh, I miss them old days. I'm glad I don't have to be chased by them Texas Rangers no more. Christ, they used to chase us all over. And more than once they crossed the Rio after us, but didn't know the country like we did. and we'd lose them in the brush and laugh.
Old Pablo was also a man who lived alone, but listening to his stories, Cole knew that old Pablo had had his share of experiences with both señoritas and señoras. He spoke often of a woman named Manuela. He even related that this woman had been the wife of a fellow named Charlie Beaudry, who used to run with Billy the Kid.
You heard of him?
Knew his brother, I think. Killed, wasn't he? A few years back?
Garrett got him. Big, tall, gringo sheriff. Gunned him down one night. Manuela told me this herself.
Beaudry's wife?
His widow by then.
Where was this?
Fort Sumner. You know of it?
No.
Down south of your ways. Real nice little place. The only thing is that damn Pecos River floods about every year and steals cattle, horses, houses, and men if they ain't careful. Even steals the dead. Snatches them right out of their graves.
And this Manuela, how'd you come to her acquaintance?
Old Pablo offered what could be described as a beatific smile, that of a shy saint.
Well, you know how it is. A man like I was then and a pretty widow like she was. Fate brought us together, I'd say. It's always fate when a man meets a woman and they get together, eh?
Cole shrugged.
I reckon.
You know what was interesting about her?
What?
Well, first she was married to this Charlie Beaudry, who I never met. Garrett killed him, too. Garrett killed a hell of a lot of people, gringos and Mexicanos. But anyway, she told me she and Billy became lovers for a bit. Then Garrett killed him. And after that she had another lover, a fellow named Hector or something. And somebody killed him over something. Then she met me, and she was reluctant to do anything with me because she said every man she met ended up being murdered. You know what I told her?
What?
I told her it would be worthy just to spend a night with her. That I'd take any man's bullet for the privilege and honor.
What did she say to that?
Old Pablo grinned.
What do you think any woman would say to that?
After his tequila ran out, old Pablo would rise slowly and go and mount his horse and ride off into the night. And Cole never knew when he might reappear again, and quite liked it that way, because one independent man understood that trait in another man. Cole and Preacher Man returned with clean dishes.
Looks like you and me will have to sleep on the floor.
Won't be my first time sleeping on a floor.
They made pallets by the wood stove and lay in its glow that filtered through the isinglass of the door and listened to the wood sap pop and crackle as the flames ate away at the chunks of split hardwood and pine. It was a comforting feeling to lie near fire like that, to feel the heat warm on your face, to be curled like dogs in your blankets, knowing that no harm could presently reach you and whatever evil existed was beyond your door. Tomorrow would have to take care of itself. Cole closed his eyes and slept. Sheriff Birdie Peach and Deputy Slade Yellowbone stepped off the stage in Red Pony, the Concord finally able to get through the snow that had melted considerably under the warm Chinook winds that blew unexpectedly. One day it could be snowing furiously, and the next the sun would be out with the temperature having risen into the 40s. The problem was, even though the snow was melted off the roads, they had turned into a thick mire of reddish-brown slather. A good six-horse team pulled them through, and at last they had arrived.
We'll go find Lou Ford, see if he has any new information for us.
Slade was his usual quiet, mysterious self, looking about the town and not seeing much he cared for. Red Pony was just like every other frontier town that didn't have a rail line running to it yet. Just a town built upon a promontory that overlooked a vast, treeless land that seemed to stretch out endlessly. Birdie didn't see anything he cared for either with regard to the town. It was too cold in the winter and too hot in the summer, and not a tree tall enough to hang a man from anywhere in sight. He was familiar with Red Pony, having been there before, the last time to pick up a prisoner and deliver him to the jailhouse in Ardmore, so he knew Lou Ford firsthand. He thought Lou to be a tad on the soft side for a lawman. Birdie and Slade stayed to the board sidewalks to avoid tramping through the thick red mud. Squeezing past folks headed their way, Birdie touching his hat brim to the ladies, Slade ignoring them, his thoughts elsewhere. His ass felt like it was on fire after that long, rugged, arduous stage ride, on which it seemed the driver had hit every rut and chuck hole in the road. They found Lou Ford just coming out of his office, a narrow wood structure that housed a two-cell jail. Lou had started for his home to have lunch with his wife, Katie, when he saw Birdie and Slade coming up the walk, Slade with a pillow under one arm and carrying a big bore rifle in his hand. Lou stopped and waited for them, knowing he'd have to hold off on lunch until his business was conducted with Bertie and Slade. He sure had his mind set on lunch, because usually, right after, he and Katie took a little nap together, and sometimes one thing led to another. He sort of had that in mind today.
Sheriff?
Slade frightened him a little, like some men did, even though he was a lot bigger and heavier a man than Slade. But size didn't have anything to do with it sometimes.
What's the latest with your expected troubles?
Lou shrugged, almost helplessly.
It might just be a rumor somebody started, or it could be that the Star Bunch is really coming. Figured we might be able to use some law down here besides me. I've got no deputies.
Why ain't you?
They up and quit as soon as they heard Sam Starr and that bunch might be coming.
Damn pussy willows.
Did manage to talk John Henry Cole and Charlie Hood and his missus into leaving town. So if Sam does show up, the least we can say is that they're not here and leave us be.
You aim to add pretty, please?
Lou shifted his weight, uncertain as to why they were prodding him.
I never thought John Henry Cole would tuck tail and run. You, Slade?
Slade stood stiff as a board, his back shifted now to the wall of the boot shop behind him, as was his wont. There had only been one man that Slade had ever met that he truly admired, Wild Bill Hickok. Slade had been a kid when he saw Hickok gun down Dave Tutt in the town square in Springfield. 5 years later, as a young man trying to make his own reputation, Slade watched as Hickok was jumped by two soldiers in a saloon in Hayes City. It was a desperate, if brief, fight, Hickok nearly being murdered, but he'd managed to shoot both men. How it came to pass that Hickok ever let anyone get behind him and shoot him in the back of the head up in Deadwood was still a source of wonder to Slade Yellowbone. The Wild Bill he'd known was forever cautious and quick to kill anyone who threatened him. But men like Slade knew it only took 1 second of inattention to your surroundings and those in it to earn you a bullet to the brain. His eyes drank in every living soul on the street.
Slade!
What?
You ever think a man like John Henry Cole would tuck tail and run?
Slade looked at him, those pitiless eyes just like staring into a rattler's, Bertie felt.
I never thought a lot of things.
Slade's mind was still on queer doings, that clerk and himself. What sort of man would his mean old daddy say he was if he knew what Slade was thinking about? His old man had been as hard as aged hickory, a two-fisted drinking son of a bitch who would and did fight anybody at the drop of a hat. And he'd get down on his knees every Sunday in the local Baptist church and howl like a dog in praise of the Lord. Rough as a cob, mean as a snake, and pious as a saint. Slade had also seen his daddy whip his ma like a rented mule, beat her right down to the ground, using his belt on her over the slightest perceived infraction. Slade's daddy was the first man Slade had ever killed. Slade had caught him with a woman in a grove of pomegranate trees. The woman bent over, her skirts hiked up and her hams bare, the old man plunging into her. Slade had gone out hunting squirrel and rabbit and whatever else he could find for the supper pot. The old man too uncaring even to put food on the table. Slade had watched him for a time, watched him go at it hard with the woman until he finished up. Slade had seen then, when she straightened up and brushed her hair off her face, that she was the neighbor's wife, Becky Barlow, old Tillis's wife, and ugly as sin. He had seen his daddy hand her a coin he took from his pocket. Where he'd gotten the money for a poke was what got to Slade the most. Soon as she'd left to go back to her home, Slade had brought his pa's pumpkin head into his sights.
Daddy!
The old man wheeled around, trying to see where the voice was coming from. Slade had stepped into the clearing. He had wanted him to see who it was who was going to kill him. Instead of acting frightened, the old man had cursed him.
You son of a bitch! I should have tossed you away at the start, boy.
Yeah, you should have.
Slade pulled the trigger. The slug had hit home with the impact of a sledgehammer against a ripe melon and blew out blood and brains in a spray that coated the fresh green grass. The old man had fallen with a thud, dead and unmoving forevermore.
There you go.
Slade walked up to his father's body and felt through the old man's coveralls for any more money and found $5. Slade had gone home and gotten a shovel. He went back and buried the old man, putting brush and rocks over the spot so nobody would stumble across it accidentally. Then he'd given the money to his mother and packed a bedroll and gone away. Killing a fellow wasn't nearly as hard as he thought it might be. In fact, knowing he could take a life so easily was a special sort of feeling Slade imagined most men would never experience. And later, he understood about Wild Bill, how he acted so coolly in a fight, how he tended to shoot first and ask questions later. Later was always a good time to ask questions. Slade also figured that to kill in the name of the law was the best way there was to take another man's life. That star and the gun to go with it were a coronation of sorts, sanctioned by the government.
Well, I never figured Cole would leave, but him being gone is less competition for us on that reward money, ain't it, Slade?
Slade nodded, only half interested in what Birdie had to say.
Which direction did Cole encounter them assassins, Lou?
Two cabins near an orchard a little ways north of here.
Best we lay over for a night, Slade, and then get a start in the morning.
Sure, Birdie. Whatever you say.
Slade was anxious to get his latest business over with so he could get back to Beaver. Lou Ford watched them cross the street, heading toward the small hotel, the mud clinging to their boots, and begrudgingly admired them for their killer ways. Birdie Peach might sound like the name of a man you'd not think was someone you'd have to concern yourself with, but he had killed any number of men since becoming sheriff. Lou had heard plenty of rumors that dead was how he preferred bringing him and Slade both. Lou felt half sorry for Sam Starr and his bunch if Birdie caught up with them. The marshal turned and headed for his and Katie's little rented house. She'd wonder why he was late for lunch, and whatever else they might end up doing that day, Lou was glad he didn't have to go after any outlaws.